September 13th, we're taping Jewish Engagements to review the second unit, which was the intricacies of Psak Halacha, what goes into a Psak Halacha. Historically, the first time a decision was made about how we determine a decision-making process was to side with Beis Hillel over Beis Shammai. The Gemara insists that decision was not a function of Beis Hillel's greater perception or greater grasp of the material, or even greater numbers. Right? We are a democracy in the sense that when making halachic decisions, we go with the numbers. Right? You know what I'm saying? But the members of the Sanhedrin would actually vote over how decisions would be made. Now, in your own personal lives, you may determine certain decisions not based on a straight elective one to the other, depending on the situation. Now, if a doctor told you you have something very serious, 80 doctors say this will help you, but 20 doctors say this will kill you, it depends on how serious the thing is. You know what I'm saying? I remember once having to take not that they put in this for the sprain that I had. And it's a whole encyclopedia that came along with the medication over all the terrible things that can happen to you for the rest of your life if you take this. So I didn't take it. You know what I'm saying? So what am I getting at? So if I find out that 9 say this isn't kosher, and 1 says it is kosher, and 1 says it's not, the general principle of psak is that this thing is kosher. Right? But in some areas, I'll just tell you, Pashup Shop, you're all going to be members of a community at some point. In some areas, regarding the community, we try to be what's called Yotzei L'chol HaDeos. I don't want to have a community where some women don't want to use the mikveh because the water was procured in a certain way that the Ravid and the Rosh and the Rif say is not good, even though 97 other rabbis say it's okay. The mikveh that any community puts up, and sometimes it's quite a great expense, tries to fulfill the position of everybody. And the same usually we say about an Eruv. We try to be as all-encompassing as possible about an Eruv. Right? Okay, just putting it out there, just to be aware of. Okay, so the first rule of Psak was that the reason why we sided with Beis Hillel was because Beis Hillel always preferred to hear the other side before coming to their own decision. Beis Shammai never cared about that. We talked about that this time. And when it comes to referring to minority opinion, it's the same reason why the Supreme Court allows for the minority opinions to be written up. And then, who knows, maybe we'll go back to that such an opinion at some point. It is not so much that you have to be held responsible for all the opinions you once had. The Talmud says that after a Sanhedrin decides comes to its decision, you're not supposed to know which individual said A or which individual said not A. That's the decision of the body, and everyone's supposed to go along with it. And you know what? If someone doesn't want to go along with it, that's also on this list here, you see? If Rabbi Eliezer was objectively right, why was he rejected? You know what I'm saying? When the Sanhedrin comes to a decision, you go along with that decision. You don't let people know on the outside who may have been affected by this. Well, I actually sided with you, but what can I do? I have to go along with the majority. Your opinion now is the majority, or don't get on the Sanhedrin. You know what I'm saying? He was determined to, according to the Gemara, a very famous Gemara, to have been objectively right. He was correct in his assessment of that particular case that had to do with Tumah and Tahara. But I'm sorry, this is a democracy here. We go after the majority of opinion, and the majority thought that you were wrong about that particular. Remember, he called upon the tree to walk across the field. He called upon the body of water to start flowing backwards. He called upon the very walls of the Beis Hamikdash to start to cave in. Right? You all know what story I'm talking about, right? About Mitzvah. Right? Right? So until a heavenly voice itself came to say that Rabbi Eliezer has a Masorah and he's always right. Each time Rabbi Yeshua pushed the voice back up to heaven and said, you stay out of this. We have to go with our experiences and the Torah is for us to live, not to be told what to do. Right? Each time God says, Bonayim Yitzchuni, which I would much prefer to translate, my children may be everlasting, not my children have defeated me. Right? Tzchuni means it made me Netzach, because now the Torah lives. It's a living document, right? Not just something in the past. So this goes back to what we talked about last class, about originalism. The modern Orthodox Jew has a greater burden than everyone else in this realm. Because the one who just wants the original intent, you know, you're familiar with this argument with the Constitution, right? The one who wants the original intent, just look at the Pesukim, look at the Gemara. Oh, we're not Karaites, but just look at the you know, the original sources, and we'll know what to do. The one who has no allegiance whatsoever to that fundamentally changes the Torah. Doesn't even appeal to the Torah anymore. There are many people who don't care about what's written in the Constitution. It was written by some bunch of slave owners who don't experience what we're going through now, right? But then the modern Orthodox Jew has to combine these two sentiments somehow. We show our allegiance and our considerable connection to Torah and its holiness, while acknowledging that some things have changed. So it's, you know, do we have our cake and eat it too? Are we being disingenuous? No, this is what I gave you some specific examples last class, you know, to give teeth to this. What Boaz did, the cases with the Avelus, right? We give you some real-life cases about how Pesach stays alive and why Rabbi Akiva didn't really appreciate Moshe Rabbeinu didn't really appreciate what was going on in Rabbi Akiva's shir, but when he said that the whole shir was based on Halacha Moshe B'Sinai, Moshe recalled the crux and the essence of what they were talking about, but not the conclusion. He didn't know where that was going, because it's a whole new situation, right? Which is question number 4 on unit 2. Describe how Rashi at the BT means Babylonian Talmud Ketubot 57b can be used in 3 examples of contemporary Pesach. So from last class to today, we're going to give them 3 or 4. But Rashi just says the end of that long Rashi, it's in the end of section 2. What that Rashi says talks about how 2 different rabbis quote Rav Yochanan in 2 different ways. So can they both be right? Of course not. You know, it's Elu Divrei Elokim Chaim. Can they both be right? Right? So this goes down to the soul of Pesach. The soul of Pesach. Let me tell you the particular case that appears in the Gemara Yevamos. The soul is more than just, are we getting it right, are we getting it wrong? Yeah, there's a lot at stake here. We're talking about a life guidance. Here's the case. Torah says that under normal circumstance, you're not allowed to marry any woman your brother was ever married to. It's a chayyuv karis. If your brother, to marry your brother's wife, even if, of course, if he's still married, so that's adultery. But if the brother died or the brother divorced her, he may never marry that woman, unless a particular circumstance requires you to marry her, which is called yibum. That requirement is that the brother died childless, when he died childless, he was still married to that woman. If he divorces this woman, it doesn't matter. She will always be chayav kares for the brother to marry or someone your brother was once married to. Right? If the brother left a child before he died, or he divorced her, he wasn't married to her when he died, you may never marry that woman. Okay? And it's chayav karis. Now, under certain circumstances, you all know what that is, it's a nisut parsha, right? Under certain circumstances, the Torah not only allows it, the Torah prefers it. Because when a man never dies without a child, who's going to remember him? Who's going to be named it? Who's going to carry on his legacy? Right? If this woman lost her young husband, or lost her husband without a child, wants to remarry, she wants to name a child after the first husband, right? What man is going to allow her to do that? You with me? You know, when a woman remarries, she's not allowed to visit the cemetery of her first husband. She's not allowed to light a candle on his yahrzeit. She's not allowed to observe the yahrzeit. Right? If she's remarried, she can't. Maybe in her mind, in her heart, you can't tell her to change that. But she's not allowed to have open manifestations of her recollection of her first husband. except when it comes to Yibum. The Torah says the first child that she has with her new husband, who used to be her brother-in-law, right? You with me so far? She shall name that child after the husband, the first husband. Why is this case different? Because right now she's married to a man who doesn't mind that she's thinking of her first husband. I miss him too. I also want him to have a memory. And I'm willing to give up something from my wife now, which is that she's thinking of another man. Every time she calls this baby and this child, she may be thinking of she'd rather be married to someone, not me, right? So I have to work on making her happy that she has a new life with someone else, and slowly, slowly, time will heal the wound of my lost brother. But someone who's not the brother of the first husband may not feel this way. You got this? Look, I'm chas v'shalom not saying a widow should never get married, remarried, but I'm just saying that this is what's going on. This is the psychology of the mitzvah of Yibum. You all with me so far? So everybody agree that Yibum fundamentally is an allowance, a mitzvah of something that otherwise is kares. Now, a very common practice in the time of the Gemara was to marry, if you had a much older brother, to marry his daughter. Very famous people in the Gemara did this. Rabbi Gamliel's brother, right, was married to Rabbi Gamliel's daughter. It's very common. You'd be surprised. It shows up in the Medrash here or something there. Right? You marry his niece. It's very common. You can't marry your aunt, but you can marry your niece. And it was done. It was very common. What happened, Nebuch? Rabbi Gamliel's brother died without a child. Who fell to him and Yibum? With me here? His own daughter. Found? I'm supposed to marry my brother's widow and name a child after him. But everyone in this room can understand that that would be absurd, that the Torah wants a man to marry his own daughter to fulfill this mitzvah. Found? That's crazy. It's one, so you might think, well, it's the Torah already allowed one. No, but marrying a daughter is Nisr Mises based in. Right? No, that's too creepy. I can't believe that the Torah. So Gemara says, not only does he not do Yibum, he doesn't even have to do Chalitza. Right? There's no even a Chalitza. There's no requirement for her to require a Chalitza for the sake of remarrying. Right? You hear what I'm saying? What with me so far? You'll see what I'm getting at. So that's too creepy. Everybody knows you're not going to marry your brother's... Ugh, my goodness, my brother's widow. Who's my daughter? Please. But what about this situation? Two brothers are married to two sisters. Right? You hear this now? Two brothers are married to two sisters. Now, my brother's wife is actually forbidden to me for two reasons. Let's say it's before Rabbeinu Gershom, or he's divorced from his first wife. My brother's wife, who was my first wife's sister, right, falls to me in Yibum because my brother, I don't want to say the words, but this man dies childless. Okay, are you with me? So here's the question, and here's the psak. It's a beautiful Gemara in Daf Lamed Bet in Meseches Yevamos. Here's the question. This man dies, and his wife falls to his brother, you got me? Who is forbidden to him outside the mitzvah of Yibum for two reasons. One, it's his brother's wife. All right, but Yibum allows that. But here, it doesn't have the same creepy factor of marrying a daughter. This woman is his sister-in-law from two directions, right? You got me? Because it's his brother's wife, but it's also his...
Wife's sister.
Right? You hear me? You following me, guys? Come on, please. All right? It's his wife's sister, which is also Karis. Right? So here's the question. Does Yibum allow two Karises? So the answer is no. Everybody agrees that. No machlokas on that. But here's the question. There was a case in the Gemara, the Lamed Beis, where a man didn't know this law. You see, the din of Yibum is not a wedding. The din of Yibum is you just take her and she just becomes your wife. Who was the shadchan for such a marriage? Who made the shirach? Who made the shirach? God. By the death of the brother, right? Gemara says, Hikno lo min ha-shamayim. This is a shirach made by God. Otherwise the man would still be alive, right? So what do you do to perform Yibum? Nothing. You just go to her house and say, take her to your house, and she says, now you're my wife. Yivamo yavo aleho. That's it. There's no marriage. Now, Chazal was misaking a marriage called Ma'amar. Mimer, where you give her a ring and you make a wedding out of it. And so not to be mezalzel, if you just become a married man by just having a woman come into your house with no shidduch, no ring, no gift, no suda. No. So you make, it's called mimer. Okay? I'm giving you a little tutorial in Maseches Yevamos now. Okay? So this man lives out in the sticks someplace. Two brothers married to two sisters. And he says, why do I have to go to a Beis Din? I learned a little bit. And he takes her into his house. And he marries. And then someone says, wait a second. That's your sister-in-law. I know it's my sister-in-law. It's my brother's wife. No, but it's your wife's sister. You can't do that. And he said, who said not? If the Torah allows me my sister-in-law for being my brother's wife, why shouldn't it allow me my sister-in-law for being my wife's sister? He says, you better call up and ask a psak about this, buddy. I think you made a mistake. You can't stay married to her. And he goes, okay, I'll ask a shayla. So he calls up his local rabbi in the next town, and he says, I'm married, I did Yibam, I did the mitzvah, I did what the halacha says, I took her into my house. Did I do something wrong? So we know universally, everybody holds, yes, you did something wrong. Is there a punishment for what I did? So what do you think? What's the nature of his sin?
Try to do the right thing.
He tried to do the right thing, but he did something chayav karis, right? He was chayav karis. He violated the Torah and the chayav karis. Ah, what's the punishment for shogeg on the karis? No. If you eat not by accident. Accidents have no punishment. Bishogeg. You ate bishogeg on Yom Kippur. You got up in the morning. You thought it was, you didn't realize it was Yom Kippur, you started, you're eating, you just ate a full kizar. What do you have to do after Yom Kippur?
Kippur,
korban. It's called the korban chatos. Right? Okay? So here's the guy's question. I married my sister-in-law, who was my brother's wife and my wife's sister. Do I have to bring one or two korbanos? Go ahead, let me see both sides here in this room. One or two? No, just please, get me through this quickly, because I just want to tell you why we're doing this. Do I have to bring one or two? It's about this big Rashi in Ksuvistaf Nun Zayin. So, Rav Chia and Bar Kapara on Daf Lamed Beis in the Sefer Ksuvis were giving Shir, asking this question in the Shir. They were learning the Sugya of Ramas, and this came up to both. And then after the shir, both shirim were over, the kids went out to recess, and we're talking about what the Rebbeim said. Rav Chia and Bar Kapara both happened to be the Talmidim Mukvakim of Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi. And each of them said a different svar in class. One said two, because was Yibum performed with this act? No, of course not. So if Yibum wasn't performed, it's either two or none. Because if Yibum performed, he didn't do an Aveira, he did a mitzvah. And if Yibum was not performed, right, you got me, because it's his wife's sister, then he should have to bring a chatos for marrying his wife's sister, and another chatos for, please tell me you're in this, for marrying his brother's wife. He married his brother's wife without doing the mitzvah of Yibum, so he has to bring a chatos for that too, said Bar Kapara. Rav Chia said no. No, he thought he was doing Yibum. He meant well. I'll cut him some slack on brother's wife. I'll agree that he has to bring a chatos for wife's sister, but I'm going to cut him slack on the brother's wife. Got it? Since he thought he was doing Yibum. The other guy says, but it doesn't matter what he thought. That's the whole point of a chatos. A chatos, no one ever means to do b'meizid. You don't bring a chatos if you did the b'meir or b'meizid. Right? He made a mistake not on one Averi, he made a mistake on two Averos. He has to bring two. And they, and it went back and forth. Now, both of them swore, the Lashon Shvua, that they heard their svara of whether two or one from Rebbe. The shame is that in today's environment, I'm sorry to say, I don't mean chas v'shalom, I want to be chas chutz. In today's environment, these two teachers would say, what are you talking about? I studied with Rebbe for 30 years. And the other one would say, what is he talking about? I'm older than he is. I was with Rebbe when Rebbe was sharper, and he told me, I asked this question specifically. There happens to be some Rebbeim who gave different Pesukei Halacha to different people. But this is too specific. I don't want, there's one answer to this question. So here's the beauty of this Gemara, and why I'm telling it to you. At the end of this discussion between the two, the next day, each one gave shir. What do you think? On all the opposite. All of the logic. We just did it in 2 or 5 minutes here, right? But they gave all the longest and the logic and other examples of two and one. And actually, if you know that Gemara, the Gemara gives another 5 or 6 similar cases where you can have either two or one tapuses, where either one slips away or one remains. And they gave that beautiful shir with Bekiyas, and they prepared in order to present the case of the other one without backing off of their own position. Each one did that the next day. That's the beauty of Pesach Halacha. Right? Now, what it means is that if you call me up and ask a question about a chicken, and I listen carefully, and I take all the data, and I give you an answer that this chicken is kosher. But it turns out that in Metzius, maybe something you failed to tell me, maybe something I didn't get right, maybe you're a beginner that I didn't interpret properly, whatever it is, it turns out that this chicken is not kosher. You didn't eat something unkosher. Right? Just as much as if a piece of ice cream falls into your chont, and the ice cream is outnumbered 200 to 1, or more than 60 to 1. Did you eat milk and meat if you ate up the whole thing? Of course you did. There's milk in there and there's meat in there. Right? Did you eat something not kosher? Of course not. That's more obvious. But there's milk in there, there's meat in there. Right? Follow what I'm saying? The determination here is a halachic process. This might be different with medicine, by the way. If the doctor tells you to take this wrong medicine, and he meant well, he did all the research of it, but the medicine counteracted on something else he didn't know, that might be in a different situation. Right? But when it comes to halacha, the halacha has certain guidelines and rules that say that follow those guidelines, you go according to the principles, then you didn't eat something unkosher. It's perfectly worthy of eating. Because what does kosher mean? Kosher means worthy, worthwhile. Okay? Alright, so that's all about the area of Pesach, and here Rashi 57b in Ksuvos brings this all down. Okay? Now let's start Unit 3 today, and we'll finish Unit 3 today and Thursday. Unit 3 is the mitzvah to love Jews, the heretic or irreligious Jews in the eyes of Halacha. There's just a few pages in the Choveret on this. You can turn to it. It looks like this. It starts off. Have it here, but you don't have copies of it. Have it in your timeline. Look for Unit 3, okay? That's what it looks like. It says, the mitzvah to love Jews, the heretic or irreligious Jew in the eyes of Allah. And it starts off with the obvious mitzvah, Behaftalecha Ramotha, it's hunky-dory, very nice. It starts off with a very interesting debate from something that took place in 1983. November 1983. It was a debate about the nature of irreligious Jews, and are they to be considered Jews? Do we still have the mitzvah to bring them in, and to not just to makariv them, but right? So here is what went on. I'm reading an article written to the Jewish world by a Rabbi Bernard Zlowitz. You find this on the right first page after Unit 3 if you have your computer here. Okay? So after I read the report of Orthodox rabbis debate issue of cooperation with reform, between rabbis Bernard Weinberger and Walter Wurzberger, I took courses in this very room with Walter Wurzberger in the 70s. He's a really great, great philosopher, great, great mind. One of the Rav's Talmidim, very special Talmidim back in the 50s, 60s, maybe even earlier. And he has since passed away. He was the rabbi of, not sure of the name of the shul, but in the Five Towns. Not the White Shul, the shul just before the White Shul.
Central Avenue. Anyway, Walter Wurzberger argued for more accommodation with reform. Rabbi Weinberger argued very much against. Right? Rabbi Weinberger declared it shocking and repulsive to set up Ben-Gurion as a hero. He would have had no Israel to build up with a generation of Jews to pray for the treasury, he said the rabbi. Right? So anyway, Weinberger argued that we should just cut off reform and have nothing to do with reform. So the director of the New York Federation of Reform Synagogues, named Bernard Zlotowitz, wrote into the newspaper that covered this story. And he said, he quotes a quote attributed to Rabbi Weinberger, "I submit to you, it's a mitzvah to hate the Reform Jew." So this is not Bernard Zlotowitz writing. "So I immediately checked the Torah and rabbinic sources to see where that mitzvah was. I saw mitzvahs about love, loving God, loving human beings, being concerned, being caring, but no mitzvah to hate. But if an Orthodox rabbi said it, it must be so. After all, he is knowledgeable in Tanakh, Talmud, Shulchan Aruch, and other rabbinic sources. So I checked these again, but I was unsuccessful a second time. Perhaps this rabbi wrote a new Shulchan Aruch, the kind that guides bigots and hate mongers." So Bernard Zlotowitz says he checked the Rambam, he checked Shulchan Aruch, he checked the Talmud, and he checked to see if there's ever a mitzvah to hate Jews. Right? And he said he didn't find any. I'm afraid he is, he didn't check far enough. Okay? While the Rambam definitely writes that it's a mitzvah to love every Jew, Shnemar v'chavta lecha kamocha, right? But he makes very clear caveats in numerous places in his writings. For instance, the Rambam codifies 13 principles of faith. Right? You familiar with them? Yigdal, Animamin, right? At the end of codifying those 13 principles, it's in this Perush HaMishnah, it's the last Perush in Sanhedrin, known as Perush Chelek. At the end of codifying those 13 principles, the Rambam writes, "Anyone who does not accept the belief of any one of these 13 principles," he accepts 12 of them, he doesn't accept 13. He thinks that God has physical features. He thinks there was some psukim added to the Torah after Moshe died. Right? Anyone who questions any one of these 13 principles of faith, it's a mitzvah to hate this person. It's a mitzvah to convince them to go down a well, and then you take away the ladder. It's, the Rambam is very, 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 very clear about how to treat the heretic Jew. Right? And he writes this in numerous places in his Mishnah Torah. And they're all here in these sources. Okay? So, Hilchos Mamrim, for instance. B'nei ha-toim ha-ele b'nei b'neihem shidichu osam avosam. V'noldu b'nei ha-karoim gadlu osam al-da'atam ha-rayim katinok shenishma. He says, there are some people, however, he writes this in Hilchos Mamrim, that there could be some people who are sinful, but they're not doing it because they are spiteful. They're doing it because that's the way they were brought up. What people were that in the time of the Rambam? There was no reform movement at the time of the Rambam. Everyone was Shomer Torah at the time of the Rambam. He makes reference to that. You've heard of Karaites? All familiar with Karaites? Have you studied them in high school? Karaim. Karaites are probably nothing but the continuation of the Dead Sea Scrolls authors, Tzedukim, by two simply people who generally just rejected oral tradition. Right? They didn't fast on Yom Kippur, they didn't wear tzitzis, right? They didn't leave their house on Shabbos, But they were very serious about Torah. They just didn't have an oral rendition of the Torah. Right? So they just took exactly the written word of they had the tzitzis on the wall where they could see it. They didn't wear it. Right? They afflicted themselves in Yom Kippur, but they didn't refrain from eating or drinking because the Torah doesn't say that. Okay? Right? So their whole Torah is like this. And he says that they're toim, they're mistaken, but they're just doing it because that's the way they've been doing it for hundreds of years. So I can't call them this category. That's known as, in the halacha, you've heard of it, tinok shenishba bein hagoyim. It's like a child that was taken captive and he's doing the wrong thing because he doesn't know better. Okay, so that's known as the concept of tinok shenishba. But on this source, on this page, I have two sources in Shulchan Aruch. Two sources in the Rambam, in addition to the Perush HaMishnah, where the Rambam clearly and the Shulchan Aruch clearly say that if the person knew better, it's known as Shon of a Parish, he knew better. He knows that there's a Torah Shlacha. He knows. He's very familiar with the halachic process, and still he turned away. This person is to be hated. So Bernard Zlotowicz didn't look up enough sources. There are plenty. The Talmud is filled with these kind of stories. However, this argument took place in 1983. Surely we don't paskin halacha by just looking at a Rambam, right? What's been written since then? So, what we have for the rest, just we'll try to give four different svaros, is on the last four pages of this section, unit 3. Make sure that you get to see them. Are four historical treatments of the modern day heretic. Most come out of Germany from the 1800s. Right? Okay, the history of heresy, if you will. The history of heresy is probably, you can say starts with Elisha ben Avuya, right? But of course there have been heretics all along. And usually they go publicly. Perhaps the most famous heretic of all time is Baruch Spinoza. Certainly of the last 1,000 years. You've probably never heard his first name, Chibi Habalti. You probably would go around as unknown, if not Ibn Ezra, who quotes him a few times in his parish. Chibi Habalti thought that the Torah was not written at the time of Moshe. And he wrote a commentary, nonetheless. Usually if you felt the Torah was written by Moshe, why bother writing a commentary? But he did. And Ibn Ezra takes issue with him at every turn. But Baruch Spinoza, you're familiar with him? Have you learned about him?
Yeah.
Baruch Spinoza was a philosopher who happened to be Jewish. Right? He's still under the ban. The Jewish community of his in Amsterdam put him under Cherib, and I believe the Cherib still stands. There's a movement now to have the Cherib officially removed. You could do whatever you want, but it has to be the body that put him into Cherem has to be the one that takes him out. Anyway, but here are the four sources. I want you to be familiar with them. One is the Binyan Zion. This is Rabbi Yaakov Ettinger, perhaps more famously known as the Aruch Haner. He was a rabbi in Germany in the mid-19th century. I know he has a lot of descendants who live here in New York now, and they're in the Breuer's community, I'll tell you. There are a lot of direct descendants of his that I'm aware of. Okay. His name was Rabbi Yaakov Ettinger. Okay. Two. Rabbi Avram Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman wrote Shalos HaTshuvos called Melameid LaHo'il. Rabbi Zvi Hoffman lived around the same time. Rabbi Yaakov Ettinger was very well received in the yeshiva world, in the Beis Medrash world. Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman was a rare, rare individual, only maybe five like him in the whole 19th century, where he was received well in the scholarly world as well as in the Torah world. Usually if you were received well in the scholarly world, the Torah world threw you out, and vice versa.
But he was very well received in both worlds. Very few people like that in the 19th century. Okay. Three, Rav Avram Yitzchak Kook, first chief rabbi of Israel. His is a tshuva. And the fourth, amazingly, is the Chazon Ish. Familiar with him? Of Karelitz in Bnei Brak. Okay. These four all have commentaries on whether what the Rambam writes about the heretic Jew should apply to us today. Okay. Alright. First, the Binyan Seal. This is it's of course 14. It's all translated by the way, so you can go online, look for this, and you can find it. Okay. I mean, unit 3, you can get a head start. These are the questions on unit 3, these four chubas. Right? You know, we'll start with these tshuvas on Thursday, but I just wanted to do one thing with you is the mitzvah of Ve'ahavta L'Reyecha Kamocha, the mitzvah to love every Jew. For one, how do you know he's talking about loving every Jew? What does L'Reyecha mean? Are we so sure that Ve'ahavta L'Reyecha means love every Jew as yourself? It says love your neighbor as yourself. How do you know that that means your Jewish neighbor? So that, I'll tell you, there the Meforshim and the people who count mitzvahs, they go in different directions on this. I'll tell you, Abravanel, you've heard of him, right? Abravanel? The Torah Tzmima, Pepsi, Torah Tzmima on Pasuk, says that Ve'ahavta L'Reyecha is meant to include everybody in your midst who is ostensibly upright. The Gentile is in your midst, and he is not pursuing you or pogroming you or, you know, the like, which is what we've experienced throughout our history. And of course you have the chiyuv to love him. And to show love to him. That's what le-re'acha. It doesn't say le-hafta re'acha kamocha. You can't do that. Other karabats. What you can do is le-hafta le-re'acha kamocha. Show him love. Right? Now, I can tell I love him. Show me the love. Right? Do something that demonstrates that you love me. Which is basically to do to him what you want to have done to you. Does that sound familiar? Do unto others as you would have them do to you. Where does that quote come from? Are you familiar? Do unto others as you would have them do to you. How about this one? What's hateful to you, don't do to someone else. Does that sound familiar too? Who said that? Someone once went to Hillel and said, I want to convert while I'm standing on one foot. Tell me your whole Torah while I stand on one foot. Right? So Hillel sized up the situation. Shammai first kicked him while he was standing on one foot. Then he went to Hillel. So Hillel said, what's hateful to you, don't do to someone else. That is the essence of our Torah. Now go learn its commentary. Everything else is its commentary. It says it converted based on that. So you accept that? Yes. All right. You're Jewish. Rashi asks, how could he, first of all, what's the message? Really, keeping kosher, taris, mishpach, and kashrus is a commentary to do unto other things, is don't do what's hateful to you? Does that make sense? So the Marsha asks this question on this Gemara and Shabbos, Daf Lamed Aleph. The Marsha answers that what the Gemara really means to say is something not intuitive. The Gemara means to say that everything we do needs a Torah imprimatur to comment on what it is that you're doing. Even something as elementary as loving someone else. Even something like tzedakah, as Hilchos Tzedakah. We need the Torah imprimatur on everything we do. Even something that comes as naturally as love. Right? The loving relationship you will have with your wife needs to be
translated and directed by Torah. Right? Okay? So, fair enough. So, here's just a question I'll leave you with for today. The first quote, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Anyone like to stab? One last stab, where does that come from? Who's the source of such a statement?
You're very far away.
It's Jesus in the New Testament. Okay. His interpretation of the Habakkuk of Malta is in the positive. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Hillel's statement in the Talmud of his interpretation, and by the way, it's the Targum Yonasan, Yonasan ben Uziel being the Talmud Mufok of Hillel. The Targum Yonasan, if it is Yonasan, to the Pasuk V'Havdecha Kamocha is exactly the Aramaic of Hillel. Madasani loch lo tavim, what's hateful to you, don't do to someone else. So Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in his commentary to the Torah wonders, why does Hillel, why is a Jewish approach to V'Havdecha Kamocha in the negative, and in the New Testament, Jesus, who ostensibly approaches this from a Jewish standpoint, he's a Jew, right? But why is the New Testament's approach, which we will minei ubei reject, but why is the New Testament describing the mitzvah of loving someone in the positive, and in the Talmud it's in the negative? Any thoughts on this? Let me ask you this question. You fall in love with someone, and you find out that someone else, whether it's a good friend of yours or not, is interested in this person also. Right? Are you going to be as happy if that person wins her heart than if you do? I can go on and on. You're trying out for a job. Right? You want to knock out everyone else who's trying out for that same job. Now, you want to do so fairly. You don't want to use foul play, of course. Right? Right? They say, oh, it's fair in love and war. But no, it's not. Right? Okay? So, what is it? What does this mean? So, all right. Christian actually teaches. And there's a story in the Talmud that I think is an excellent example of this. You are alone in a desert with another person. How you know this, I don't know. In Mitzvahs, I don't think this has ever been a psak halacha in the history of mankind. And it shouldn't be. But you just have enough water for only one to survive, and that's your water. So there's a guy in Bab Mitzvah of Samach Beis named Ben Vitoro who says, you should split it. What? Hope for a miracle? The Gemara's Metzius is that you know that if you do that, you're both going to die. Again, how we know that, I don't know. So that's why it's not Metzius. Because Metzius, why we split it and hope for a miracle? Maybe who knows? Especially today, it might be a helicopter flying above, right? So I'm going to hold out as much as possible together. The Chiyachicha Imach. Share the destiny. Ad Shedorash Rabbi Akiva. The Omar v'cheyachicha imach, he shall live with you, but not at your expense. Keep the water for yourself. Right? That's not the Christian approach, by the way. The Christian approach is that, I mean, after all, if you had the water, would I like it if you gave it to me so that I could live and you die? Would that make me happy? I may have trouble sleeping at night, and I may have... But you know what? I have 6 kids. He's not even married. Right? I'll start to justify what I should get the water. Right? You get it? In other words, your mind can start to play haywire on you when you're very thirsty in the desert. And wouldn't you like it if he offered it to you? Would you? Come on, be up front with me. So then, you have to do that for him. And you know what's going to happen in the Christian world? Excuse me, the philosophers
say this. They're both going to die. Why? Not because they shared it. But because they kept saying, no, you have, no, you, no, you, no, you. And I'm not, I don't mean to be funny with that. Because do unto others as you would have them do unto you just doesn't work as a moral philosophy. That's why Hillel says it in the negative. That's Shutur Kolarsh. It's in his Sheetos. Right? You with me? Okay. That's why it's don't do to others what you would what you don't want to have done to you. Okay? So, look, who doesn't have thoughts here and there that stray? You know, I want to be, I still want to be part of a community. I want to be part of something. Right? My thoughts should get me... Alright, so the Rambam says, okay, we understand. Shigagos. He's mistaken. Yes, that certainly would be the case today. But here before you, these are the four commentaries we will be analyzing next class. Make sure, print them up. It's just all on about 2 pages. Print them up. It's in unit 3. It's a small unit. Get it. Okay? It will say Jacob Ettlinger. It says Rav Avraham Yitzchak Kook. It says David Zvi Hoffman. It says Chazon Ish. It's all very clearly spelled out. Okay? It's on page 4 and 5 on the Chuvaret here. Okay? So make sure to get that. And we will take it from there. Next class, Mitzvah Hashem. All right? And yeah.